From NPR News in Washington, I'm Melinda Pencava, and this is Talk of the Nation. 3 years ago this summer, families began moving into Celebration, a brand new town in Florida conceived, marketed, and built by the Disney Corporation. Laura Adams was one of the first residents.
I think it's the whole sense of community, the unity, and you want to know your neighbor. And it's terrific. You feel safe. It's a lot better than, I think, in other areas. Somebody told us it's like moving to Mayberry. And that's kind of true.
3 years later, she and her family have moved away, as have some others, discontent with the way Disney ran or didn't run things. Were expectations too high? What does it say for other planned communities? The lessons of Celebration. Today's Talk of the Nation, after this news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. A gunman opened fire inside a Jewish community center in a suburb of Los Angeles today, injuring three young boys and two adults. At least one of the children was critically injured. The gunman is described as a white male wearing a bandana. From Los Angeles, NPR's Andy Bowers has the latest.
I know that all of the children in the community center and the day camp have now been evacuated. Police have sealed off the area around the community center because one or possibly two gunmen, there are some unconfirmed reports that there was a second gunman, that they are still at large in the area, and the police are trying to keep everyone away from there until they have apprehended or figured out what happened to these gunmen or gunman.
NPR's Andy Bowers reporting from Los Angeles. The incident occurred at the North Valley Jewish Community Center in Granada Hills in California's San Fernando Valley. Most of the children at the facility were away on a field trip today. Those remaining joined hands and were led or carried out to safety by police who have now surrounded the complex. This latest shooting incident at a school or workplace in the United States ironically comes on a day when the government released a survey showing a decline in the number of students caught with guns in schools. NPR's Sanchez reports.
The 50-state survey conducted by the U.S. Education Department shows that between 1996 and 98, the number of students expelled for firearms possession dropped from 5,700 to 3,900. That's a 31% decline. 7 out of every 10 expulsions involved handguns, rifles, or shotguns. The rest involved grenades and homemade bombs. Over half of the students expelled were high school students. Federal law mandates that kids caught with guns be expelled for at least a year. What's less clear is where these kids end up, in correctional facilities or in alternative education programs. The U.S. Education Department today stressed that school shootings like that of Columbine High School in Colorado are an aberration, but that school districts need a lot of help from law enforcement agencies because too many of them don't know how to make their schools safer. I'm Claudia Sanchez, NPR News, Washington.
Former rebel soldiers in Sierra Leone have freed their remaining captives, ending a 5-day hostage crisis. Among those released today were 15 West African troops and some 200 civilians, most of whom were children abducted during the African nation's civil war. Indian warplanes shot down a Pakistani naval surveillance jet in a coastal area today, killing at least 16 servicemen who were aboard. India says the aircraft was shot down after intruding into Indian airspace and failing to respond to warnings. But Pakistan says wreckage of the plane was found in Pakistani territory, and a Pakistani official called the attack unprovoked aggression. The incident comes just a few weeks after India and Pakistan went to the brink over the disputed territory of Kashmir. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 55 points in active trading. On the NASDAQ, the composite down 49. This is NPR News. Stock prices remain sharply lower today as investors take their cue from the deteriorating bond market backdrop. The Dow has been down more than 150 points at some points today. After rallying early in the session, bond prices have returned to their losing ways. The price of the 30-year Treasury is down 9/32nds, while the yield is at 6.25%. A class action lawsuit in Illinois against State Farm Insurance could settle a debate over auto parts that has gone on for more than a decade. Dan Spray of member station WBEZ explains.
5.5 million people are filing a class action suit against State Farm that could cost the Illinois-based company more than $2 billion. The suit was prompted by complaints from consumers that State Farm insisted on body shops using substandard replacement parts. In one case, a woman picked up her car from the repair shop and discovered that the hood didn't fit and the headlights were loose. She spent the next year battling with State Farm, contending it forced the shop to use cheap parts not made for her specific vehicle. Lawyers for the plaintiffs say State Farm breached its contract with customers and violated consumer fraud laws when it required shops to use parts that don't return cars to the condition they were in before the accident. State Farm argues the materials, called aftermarket replacements, are just as good as original parts, and they help keep repair costs down for consumers. For NPR News, I'm Dan Spray in Chicago.
Electronic commerce is getting a makeover at the nation's largest automaker, GM, moving all of its internet ventures under one organizational roof. Repeating our top story, three children and two adults were shot and wounded today when a gunman opened fire inside a Jewish community center in suburban Los Angeles. Police are searching for the gunman, described as a white male. I'm Craig Windham, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, and the Geraldine R. Dodge Foundation for reporting on biological resource issues.
This is Talk of the Nation. Ray Suarez is away. I'm Melinda Pencava. The suburbs are sprawling. While many people are moving into the suburbs in that sprawl as development gets farther and farther from the city center, there are also more and more people who say they can do without the large yards if in exchange they get a community that was more like the smaller homes and towns of other decades. Some architects are responding to this demand, designing these towns from the ground up. The more recent town in this of these is Celebration, Florida. It made a splash when it opened 3 years ago, largely because the Disney Corporation was behind it. Celebration is in Osceola County, near Orlando and Disney World. The town opened and the first families moved in 3 years ago, lured by that idea of a small-town community with state-of-the-art features. And the Disney name didn't hurt in marketing it, either. It wasn't so much a planned community as a planned paradise. And as happens with planned paradises, not all the high expectations were met. This hour, we'll look at just how far you can go in planning how people live and function, and what it means for those efforts to get away from the subdivisions and sprawl going on elsewhere in the country. Our guests this hour are Andrew Ross, a professor and director of the American Studies program at New York University. He spent a year living in Celebration, Florida, and that has led to a forthcoming book, The Celebration Chronicles. Welcome to Talk of the Nation, Andrew Ross.
Thank you.
And Elizabeth Plater-Zyberg, who is Dean of the School of Architecture at the University of Miami and a principal at Duane Plater-Zyberg Architects and Town Planners. 19 years ago, that firm brought us the town of Seaside, Florida. Welcome to the show.
Good afternoon.
And if you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Well, I'll start out with you, Andrew Ross. The Celebration Chronicles is about your time in Celebration. What was it like to live there, and what did you not anticipate there?
I have to say it was a unique opportunity for a writer to be able to go and spend a year in the first large-scale planned development in America in the last 30 years, and to witness close up how the pioneer wave of residents there were coping with their new lives and how they deal in essence with this new kind of urban design that is very close to new urbanist town planning of the sort that Elizabeth has also pioneered in Florida and other places. For me, it was a unique opportunity, and also I knew I was doing really the first study from the inside of a new urbanist town, so I was also conscious of that responsibility.
Mm-hmm. So going into it, what did you expect?
You know, I can't even remember what my preconceptions were, because when you move into a town like Celebration, you very quickly discover that it's a real town with real people, real problems, not a theme park village cooked up by the Walt Disney Imagineers. And within a few weeks, I guess most of my preconceptions had dissipated entirely. I couldn't remember what they were. And I just got down to work becoming a part of community life and spending my time with the residents and also interviewing them. I spent 600 or 700 hours of interviewing of the residents and employees there.
Mm-hmm. And when they went into it, they were attracted to this place because it was their sense of community was part of the pitch there, and you weren't going to be as dependent on cars and so on. And it was like a return to yesteryear.
I think there were a lot of reasons, obviously, why different people were. There's a fairly diverse group of people who moved there. In retrospect, most of the families, the parents who I interviewed, said that they'd moved there for the school, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And the school in particular was a central source of controversy and continues to be so in Celebration, for reasons I think that are quite unique to Celebration and the Disney Company.
Mm-hmm. Well, Elizabeth Plater-Zeiberg, you've been at this for a few decades now with Seaside Florida. Tell me how what you have learned over the past few decades about this. Have your expectations changed on what can be accomplished with this new urbanism of taking a place and making a town right from the ground up?
Well, you know, interestingly enough, those of us who've been involved in these endeavors, and of course there are many of these new urbanist communities going up all over the country, as well as old neighborhoods being revived following these traditional principles of community making. I think one thing that we would all agree on is that these are places of very rich experience, that they're as different from one another as they are in different places, and that there are many wonderful factors that come into play in terms of making these communities.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's the future for them? Is the demand high, or for I guess people who don't want the more cookie cutter experience of most of the subdivisions that are going up in the U.S. right now?
Well, of course, there are people who say, I really like my big lot and I don't want to know my neighbors. And we've built plenty of places like that. But we've experienced, and obviously perhaps that's because we're involved in this arena, that there's been a tremendous public response to the idea of either helping communities rebuild or making new places that facilitate community. I think it's important to understand that communities are made of people, not just buildings or landscape or paving. And those of us who work on the side of creating the physical fabric, the backdrop for that activity, are presenting one piece of the puzzle. And there's a tremendously complex aspect that has to do with human interaction. That in a sense is up to the people who are there.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have to wonder if, you know, the pitch is that this sense of community and the community is the people, but we're talking about rather a planned community, and you often can't plan for how people are going to interact with each other there, can you?
Well, that's true, and in some untoward circumstances, you will find people struggling and succeeding to have a very strong sense of community.
Mm-hmm.
But very often you can identify that there are breaks in the physical pattern that reflect the breaks in the community. And I guess those are the things that those people who are involved in creating communities of place are interested in improving on.
Mm-hmm. Well, Andrew Ross, what did you find in Celebration, which was, you know, the Disney town? Where would it be like you would find, as you would find in any other place, with the way people interacted? Or was there a different twist to it because it was planned and Disney's involvement in it?
Celebration is a kind of unique community for all sorts of reasons, not least of all the Disney factor, which although Disney really only functions there like any other real estate developer, its presence sort of permeates daily life of the citizens in a way that is really quite profound. In terms of the success as a community, I mean, I'm agreeing with what Elizabeth says about how these new urbanist communities are all different in their own ways. If they're successful from a commercial point of view, and Celebration has been, the resale value is good and the housing prices rise, then one of the original plans, of course, behind the town, which is to have a mixed income community where low-income residents can live a stone's throw away from million-dollar mansions, which was the case while I was living in Celebration, that plan becomes less easy to maintain because as the housing prices rise, really low-income people can't live there, and that's almost already the case with Celebration. It's pretty much the story with Seaside also, which was certainly wasn't originally planned to be a high-income community predominantly. So from the commercial point of view, there is that problem. Commercial success means that the sociological complexity of the town is reduced to something that is more monolithic, monocultural.
Mm-hmm. So you have this community there, but the market forces outside of it are having an effect. You can't be immune to that.
Exactly. And from another perspective, how you would assess community, let's say, from a more sociological perspective, I mean, one of my tests would be a lot of community-minded people moved into Celebration. They were a kind of self-selecting group of people. They were likely to be highly participatory in the town's activities. Although, I have to say, I discovered some hermits living there, which is the last place you would expect to find hermits. But the real test of a community, I think, is to what extent that citizenly energy overflows into the outlying areas and into communities and among neighbors who perhaps are less fortunate than the folks who live in towns like Celebration. So the real test is whether I think the community uses its energies to strengthen its own bonds internally and becomes more sort of tightly closed off, or whether it becomes more of a model for how you might live in the region at large, mm-hmm. and uses its talents and resources to help out others who are perhaps less fortunate.
Because right now, I'm sorry, go ahead.
That for me was one of the stories that I discovered about Celebration, and really that question remains to be answered.
Mm-hmm. And with planned communities or new urbanism, whatever you might like to call it, it's in pockets right now across the country. It's clearly not it's not the overwhelming way to go as far as development, is it? And that makes me wonder, you alluded to that a second ago, the idea that you have a place like Celebration, but if it's in a county that is large, where the construction, the look of it, and the economic level is a whole lot different from what Celebration was. Celebration was very upscale, and it was in a relatively poor county. You know, what does that say? Is it always just going to be this refuge for the people who live there? And does it ever kind of, or do you have it trickle down to the people around it?
I'm sorry,
Elizabeth, and then Andrew. Go ahead, Elizabeth Plater-Seiberg.
It doesn't need to be that way. And I think that certainly all the intentions behind new community building on the new urbanist model are of a larger social integration. But one of the reasons these new places are still occurring in small increments is that many of them have fought a very difficult battle against conventional regulatory systems that in fact preclude building a traditional neighborhood or a traditional town. And it's only in recent years that counties and cities and towns have begun to change zoning codes and land use plans in order to either allow or encourage a traditional neighborhood to be built. So one of the things that I think people don't understand, and since Celebration is the focus here in particular about Celebration, is that this wasn't just a kind of easy invention that was like a new product which you would put on the market and it would be perfect. You know, a few bugs would be ironed out and right away you'd have this new kind of commodity that we could continue buying endlessly. It really was a great struggle to overcome existing patterns of development, whether it's the zoning codes, whether it's what the market studies say, which keep repeating what has been built before, whether it's banking practices, even working with a school district these days is extremely difficult to try something new. So I think there are a number of us who appreciate the lengths to which Celebration went in order to do everything, I think, that was possible to make this as ideal a structure for community as possible.
Mm-hmm. Andrew Ross?
Well, I'd certainly agree with that, and I think a certain amount of credit has to go to the company for taking on those risks and for fighting for that urban design. What I found, however, is that there's another story to tell about this, which is the regional challenge, the challenge of regional planning. Basically, the company used the celebration plans to obtain permits from the state, environmental and development permits, which covered the next 20 years of development for Disney's core retail business, the theme parks, in other words, in Central Florida. And so basically what that will mean is generating much more development in the nature of tourist sprawl in the region, the very thing that Celebration is supposed to be an antidote to. So I found that the company had two hands at work on the land, a right hand which was building a showpiece, environmentally sustainable town in Celebration, and the other hand which was contributing directly to the kind of sprawl that Celebration was supposed to combat in the first place.
And you're listening to Talk of the Nation. We're going to take a short break and we'll take your calls. 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. At 21 past the hour, it's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Welcome back to Talk of the Nation. I'm Melinda Pencava. Today we're talking about new urbanism and the town of Celebration, Florida, and what life is like in this Disney-planned community. Joining us right now are Dr. Brian Haas. He is chairman of the ophthalmology department at Orlando Regional Medical Center and a plastic surgeon. Dr. Haas has lived in the town of Celebration for the past 3 years. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Also on the line is Ron Dixon, a retired general contractor who decided to move to Celebration but left disappointed after a year. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Well, let's start out. Brian Haas, what is it that you like about Celebration? I imagine you like the place because you remained there after 3 years. What was it you were looking for and what did you find?
Well, obviously there are many amenities to it, and the fact that so many things are within walking distance, such as restaurants and movies and recreational facilities and the school. I can walk my kids to school before I go to work every day. My wife and I had lived in New York City, of all places, about 10 years ago, and you know, one of the things we liked about living in an urban environment is that so many things were at your fingertips, so to speak. It's hard to find that in suburban communities or in suburban towns, but in some way, Celebration recreates that effect to on a lesser extent and actually on a aesthetically in some ways more pleasing effect.
Mm-hmm. So now when you're home, do you find yourself having to leave the town limits or when you're not working?
Exactly right. It's like as many of my friends who live in New York, let's say, or Washington, D.C., who need to get away, so to speak, to vacation homes in the Hamptons or up in the Catskills or whatnot. I really feel like I come home and I am not only at my home, but I'm at my vacation home too, because things are so much more relaxing there than they would be if I had to go, you know, through traffic just to take my kids to a restaurant or to the movies or to go play golf with them, or I had to go through all kinds of traffic ordeals just to get them to school. As I say, one of the nice things for me, I'm a very busy professional like many people are these days, and my wife is also a physician. One of the nice things for me is things like the fact that I can walk my kids to school mm-hmm. in 5 minutes before I take off and come to the office. But I will say this, I'm as opposed to many people who came long distances to settle in Celebration, Celebration ended up being where my wife and I needed to live. Her practice is in the opposite direction, west of the city, and mine is east of the city. So we were rather fortunate that Disney decided to plop down Celebration where we needed to live.
Mm-hmm. Well, Ron Dixon, you have an alternate take on Celebration. You lasted a year there. What were you looking for, and what was it that made you move away?
Well, I believe the propaganda that Disney put out about the quality of construction and about the world-class school that would be in Celebration. I found that two of the builders did an absolutely terrible job of building townhouses and freestanding houses, and also was greatly disappointed that over 70 families pulled their children out of the school and sent them elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. Now, the school was a flashpoint. It was supposed to be state-of-the-art. It was very progressive. It was a kindergarten through 12 without report cards and not the kind of structure you were accustomed to in a classroom.
That's right. Many of the parents felt that their children were not learning anything and that some children were actually going backwards, forgetting things they had learned in schools before they moved to Celebration.
Mm-hmm. So what was the grievance process for that like? Because Celebration, it does not have a town council. It does not have a body of government, as I understand it. So how would you try to get that resolved in there?
Which one do you want to talk about, construction problems or the school problem?
The school problem. Well, either one. I guess I'm talking generally about if you had a grievance, who do you go to?
Well, let's talk about construction problems because they came up first. I very carefully documented many of the construction problems and took them to the town manager and was completely rebuffed and told to go away. The Celebration Company seemed to stonewall all problems. They denied that any problems existed, and they refused to help homeowners solve the problems.
Mm-hmm. So where could you go? And how about on an issue like the school? Which, if parents have a trouble with a school in other places, they would go to the school board, complain, and maybe changes would be made or maybe they wouldn't. What was the process you would go through in a planned community?
You would meet the same stonewalling if you tried to bring up problems and ask for solutions. Several of us got about 140 people, parents, to attend a meeting where we listed our concerns about the school. And then I was sent out to interview six families who had pulled their children out of school. Many of these parents were afraid to speak out publicly because of fear of retribution to those children, or perhaps they worked for Disney or some of the companies that did business with Disney. But I was not afraid of retribution or whatever. Mm-hmm. So I presented my report to the families, and the Celebration Company said, "Everything is fine. We've addressed the problems. There are no other problems remaining." And the parents became furious about this stonewalling.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dr. Haas,
yes.
You remain in Celebration.
Yes.
If you have a problem with government, where do you go?
Government or the school?
Yeah, if you have a problem with the things that we would associate outside of Celebration, like a school system is part, there would be a government body you could go to.
Well, there is a town manager, and that serves as our form of governance, and they are receptive to input from the community. I do believe that it's not a traditional form of government, although there is some plan over 15 years to phase something like that in.
In other words, you'd vote for people?
Down the road, I think that's the plan. Mm-hmm. With the school is a public school. It was always planned to be a public school, and for my part, I was always skeptical of a lot of the hype that went into promoting the school. My feeling was that I wanted to adopt a wait-and-see attitude. See, from my point of view, I had to compare the school to the available alternatives. And the available alternatives in where I live in Florida are not very good, quite frankly.
Other county schools.
Even right. In the private sector.
Mm-hmm.
So I have adopted a more wait-and-see attitude. And I would agree that there are things about the school that I am not fully happy with, and my wife would probably even be more word that more strongly. But in the sense that I always knew that there was a lot of hype that went into it, because that's the way communities and developments promote all their materials, just like any other development.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was a little skeptical, and I've adopted a wait and see attitude. So far, I don't believe my children have suffered. I've had four children in the school. One graduated from high school last year. Two of them are, I think, in fourth and second grades now, and I think they're where they should be, but there are things that could be better. I don't have any doubt about that,
mm-hmm.
And the way you address that is through parents, community, PTA, and going to the school board. For instance, I'll give you an example, and they do respond. When the school was supposed to start at 9 o'clock, or 9:15 this year, 9:30 I think even, a bunch of parents got together and said, that's way too late. I mean, what are we going to do with the kids? That's way too late. They formed a petition, went to the school board, agitated, if you will, and to my surprise, within a month or two, that schedule was changed, and now school's starting at 7:30. Mm-hmm. Of course, now there are parents complaining that that's too early. Mm-hmm. So unfortunately, with any new community, what often ends up happening that doesn't have an identity, many people move there, and I think Dr. Ross put it very well when he said it was a self-selected group. People come there, and one of the things that I think they like to do or would like to do is sort of impose or help shape that identity. Mm-hmm. But for 2,000 people, of course, there are going to be many, if not 2,000, conceptions of what that identity should be. Mm-hmm. So I think one of the important things that needs to happen in celebration is exactly what Professor Ross alluded to, is necessary for a community to prosper, and that is a sense of common goals and commonness. And in that area, I think the verdict is still out about how Celebration is doing.
Well, I have one final question for Ron Dixon. You moved away from Celebration. Would you move into a planned community again?
Yes, but I would want to see how they were going to handle the general contractors and so on. The people who started the Town of Celebration had no concept of how to manage the construction of the homes, how to supervise the contractors, or the sales tactics used by the sales staff that they set up.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I thank you both for your time. Thanks for joining us today.
You're most welcome.
You're very welcome.
Ron Dixon is a retired general contractor and a former resident of Celebration, Florida. Dr. Brian Hass is a plastic surgeon and chairman of the ophthalmology department at Orlando Regional Medical Center. He lives in Celebration. Our guests this hour are Andrew Ross, a professor at New York University and director of the American Studies program there. He's also author of The Celebration Chronicles, which stems from the year he spent living in Celebration, and Elizabeth Plater Zyberg, who is dean of the University of Miami School of Architecture and principal at Duaney Plater Zyberg Architects and Town Planners. And we will be taking your calls, 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Lee is in Albany, California. Hi there, Lee.
Good afternoon.
Afternoon.
There's an expression that everybody should remember, from rags to rags in three generations. Celebration is now in its first growth. The second growth will maintain it, and the third will have to fix it up and repair it, or it will diminish. Speaking as an architect and as a practicing city planner, without a council, without a place where individuals can express their views, be it on fire or police or garbage or signing or lighting or cleanup or anything, you don't have a town. You have nothing more than a commercial product. This is a Mickey Mouse community. Don't refer to it as a town. It has no soul, because basically all it is just a new birth. It's new birth. It'll go through the process of maturity, and it'll go in the process of decline and eventually death, the way it goes right now, as many cities do, and then it'll have to be rebuilt again. The name Celebration is almost an insult to anybody who has any intelligence, because it indicates that you're on a high all the time. It does not have any soul.
What would you have named it instead?
Beg your pardon?
What would you have named it instead?
I would say that would have to be something that somebody would have to do based on historical aspects of things. Maybe there's something involved in the history of the area that could be incorporated. Mm-hmm. Maybe there's something that has tradition that people can relate to it. Mm-hmm. You can't relate to something that just is a balloon and a banjo show.
Well, Andrew Ross, you've spent a year living there, and Lee is presenting a number of points here about this idea that you can't call it a town when people don't really have a council, a say in getting things done or, you know, getting grievances taken care of.
On the topic of the name, really, there's a very old American tradition of naming towns like Harmony, Eden, Amity. Celebration is very much in that lineage, sort of new utopian communities. So I wouldn't attach too much significance to the name in that regard. There's a lot of debate among town residents about governance, as you can imagine. We live in a country where millions and millions of people live under forms of private government now in homeowners associations, and Celebration is certainly one of those. It has a very complicated structure of governance, actually, which I couldn't even begin to describe here on air. It would take me a long time, and most of the residents don't actually understand it, but It's pretty much in keeping with those other kinds of developments where after two-thirds of the lots are sold, the control over the homeowners association passes into the hands of the residents. And after 9,000 people live in town, by state law, residents are required to vote on the incorporation of the community, at which point it could become a municipality of its own. And I would predict the Celebration residents would probably vote to do so. The kind of town that results from that is something called a contract city, which means it's kind of privatized city with very few of the municipal offices that are actually in the public payroll, with a lot of services that are subcontracted out. Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of, I think at this point, that's the kind of future, political future, that I would predict for Celebration, the town, as Lee referred to.
But if I could, sure,
I have to tell you one thing, that you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Sorry, that's the business I have to do here. Go ahead.
This issue of governance is very interesting because, in a sense, Celebration allows us to speak about it, but it's not a Celebration problem. Now that we have metropolitan areas that are made of multiple municipalities, county governments, myriad homeowners associations, these private governments, the picture is very unclear at that regional scale that Andrew mentioned earlier this afternoon. And a community like this can graduate into a real municipal government. At the same time, there are other parts of the country, like Dade County, Miami-Dade County, where I'm from, in which there are enormous discussions going on about that, in fact, groups of residents or specific parts of the county should not be allowed to incorporate and become governments of their own. And so there are many sides to this story, but it's very clear that it's not, it's an issue that's much of the country's working on with governments seceding, incorporating. We're in a state of flux in that way. And these new communities, many of which start out as homeowners associations, largely under the control of the developer, are a very interesting part of that trend that's going on now. Seaside, for instance, recently did transfer into the control of the homeowners and is having its own growing pains from the first few years of that experience.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Our guests are Elizabeth Plater-Zyberg and Andrew Ross, and Vaughn is with us now from Williamsburg, Virginia. Hi there.
Hi, how are you all doing?
Okay, how are you?
I've been listening with great interest. One of the things I wanted to comment on is the impact of planning on our social environment, given some of the outbreaks we've seen with teens and violence, and even adults and violence news of late. I think there is an impact that the planning has on that with regard of how we lay out a subdivision. You hear a lot of teens talk about the fact that there is nothing to do. Things, the malls are being 3 and 4 or 5 miles away from them, but there's no safe way of walking there. The corridors don't lead to that. That was one of the things that brought about the new urbanism, by putting in those walkable pedestrian corridors in there. Most of the country, as you've talked about, that country designed from 1960 to the late 80s, didn't have this in there, and I think it's something that's not in our public discussion enough. I think a lot of the things that we're seeing are outgrowths of this planning. I wanted to hear some of the comments and what they thought about your younger population and Celebration.
Mm-hmm. Andrew Ross?
Oh, boy, that's a good question. I would probably be less less willing to acknowledge the great power of physical design over determining community than perhaps Elizabeth might. But I'm not a planner, so it's not my professional commodity. As in most suburban places, I found in Celebration that the teenagers were really the last people that the planners had thought about in terms of providing amenities. It's very difficult to plan anything for teenagers because they pretty much reject whatever, you know, they're offered. And the best thing you can really do for teenagers is provide a space which they can customize for themselves in very creative ways. So it's almost impossible to plan for teenagers from the point of view of an urban planner, I think. In Celebration, again, uniquely perhaps, the teenagers have an awfully difficult time in the school because there was so much pressure there. The housing prices are tied to how well they perform at school. In that neck of the woods, housing prices can vary up to 15% depending on the test scores at the local school.
And you're listening to Talk of the Nation. I'm Melinda Penkava. Our guests are Andrew Ross and Elizabeth Plater-Zybrick. We're going to take a short break right now, and when we come back, we'll continue talking about life in the Disney-planned community of Celebration and other planned communities, and take your calls, 1-800-989-8255. At 40 minutes past the hour, it's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Support for National Public Radio comes from National Public Radio Stations and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Borders, books, and music, where imaginations can run wild. More than 240 locations across the country and online at www.borders.com. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. And Digital Express, a resource to the insurance and financial service industries for distance learning and corporate communications, on the web at digxpr.com. This is NPR National Public Radio.
I'm Linda Wertheimer. In Russia, child advocates have long deplored the condition of the country's orphanages. Later today, we pay a visit to foster parents with a different sort of arrangement. A large working farm for many foster families, a commune for kids, and the day's news coming up on NPR's All Things Considered.
Welcome back to Talk of the Nation. I'm Melinda Penkava. Tune in at this time tomorrow. We'll be talking about this Saturday's Republican straw poll in Ames, Iowa. With the presidential election more than a year off, the question is, does this poll really mean anything? That's tomorrow at this time. Today, though, we're talking about Celebration Florida and the difficulties of trying to plan the ideal community. Our guests are Andrew Ross, a professor at New York University and director of its American Studies program and author of The Celebration Chronicles, and Elizabeth Plater-Zybrick, who is Dean of the University of Miami School of Architecture and Principal at Duane Plater-Zybrick Architects and Town Planners. If you'd like to join us, our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. And Babak is in Cleveland, Ohio. Hi there.
Good afternoon.
Afternoon.
I was calling to ask your panel to address race and class as it relates to new urbanism. Earlier in the show, Professor Ross mentioned that the sociological complexity of the town, in this case, Celebration Florida, is diminished by market forces or increased housing costs. Do you or the panel think that this monolithic population, as Mr. Ross called it, is entirely due to market forces, or is it possible that the monolithic population is an inseparable facet of new urbanism itself? By that I mean, to what extent is the design and form of new urbanism a limiting force, that attracts only a certain class and race of people, basically creating upper and middle class enclaves where social realities can be ignored?
Elizabeth?
You know, I have to jump in on that because new urbanism is the only movement, in a sense, in the country that is attempting to deal with the social striation which now exists in the physical fabric. And you must understand that the conventional building of suburbs, which has occurred for the last 40 years, has institutionalized the separation by price-pointing house subdivisions separately, and it's an almost intractable problem. The fact that in a place like a Celebration or in other new urbanist communities, you actually have single-family houses, townhouses, apartments, all within walking distance or around the corner from each other, is already an enormous improvement from what has been being built in this country in the last 40 years. So this is a movement which is working on that problem, which we all agree needs to be dealt with.
Yeah, I would agree, but I would also ask the aesthetic design, does that sort of attract a certain amount of people? And in practice, you know, you could design something that will, you know, theoretically attract lower income people, but...
But that's going to be the price tag that's going to attract that.
Well, that's not the issue. You're from Cleveland, and we've worked on a piece of your city, as have a number of other designers, to try to bring back some of the traditional neighborhoods, which were modest to begin with, are close to downtown, close to work, close to transportation. And those have generated the interest generated in this concept by those communities, by the people who were left in them, who wanted to rebuild them, was indeed very strong. And one might even argue that was a way of seeking community in which the physical fabric could help those people rebuild the places. The Cleveland Central neighborhood is one that I'm referring to. But those people came to us and said, that neighborhood came to us and said, you know, we want seaside here in Cleveland Central. And we said, that's not appropriate. It's a resort. It's probably too costly. It's a different climate. And they said, if it's good enough for them, it's good enough for us. And we had to agree with that. And I think what you should do is go down there and talk to some of the people living there.
Ruby joins us now in Santa Rosa, California. Hi, Ruby.
Hi. We're going to be starting something like this out here because the old air base in Marin County is being taken over by the city to make it fully livable for everybody. So I'm just listening to everything that's said here. So is Celebration set up with maybe groups of homes being a certain price range? And do they change?
Andrew Ross?
Yeah, I can address both questions, really. I agree with Elizabeth that New Urbanism's really making a serious attempt to address some of these issues, and it's the only planning movement that is doing so. Celebration is really one of the few places that I've been to where there's such a high mix and density of income in such a sort of limited space. The race issue is another matter, and I just wanted to return to what the gentleman from Cleveland asked about and throw in gender as well, because in what I discovered was that the group perhaps in town who benefited most from the physical design were the single mothers, for whom the community functioned as a kind of co-parent, and it was unquestionably easier for them to manage their lives and the lives of their children in a place like Celebration than it would have been in a conventional suburban development. On the race question, it was not foreordained, of course, that Celebration would turn out to be a predominantly white community. There's nothing the company would have liked more than to have a larger spread of ethnic and racial diversity in town. That didn't turn out to be the case, and a good chapter of my book is about the reasons that people offered for that. The most popular reason that was offered was really that, let's say, for black middle-class families who've achieved a level of material comfort, it's more difficult for them to sacrifice, quote-unquote, certain things that the money can buy, large houses, small lots, and the degree of privacy that you ordinarily get in suburbia for a certain price. These things you have to sacrifice, quote-unquote, to live in a new urbanist community. And people found it was easier for white middle and upper middle class families to do that, sociologically speaking.
Was it also an attraction to people who lived in the suburbs already because they knew what the standard suburbs were like? Did you find that to be the case? And that they wanted you know, a separate standing home, perhaps, but they wanted to be closer together and not have to get in the car for everything.
Well, curiously enough, it's becoming a mark of prestige among New Urbanist dwellers, that the more prestigious location is one in which the houses are closer together and the less distance you have to go to work, which is almost the inverse of what used to be the rule in suburbia. And I think that's a good thing in general. And it's true what you say, Melinda, most of the folks who'd moved there were from other suburbs. This is much different situation than it was 20, 30 years ago, where people were still moving out from cities. Mm-hmm. The traffic now out there is inter-suburban.
Mm-hmm. Doug is in Hilton Head Island, South Carolina. Hi there, Doug.
Good afternoon.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm enjoying this very much. I've been somewhat a student of the concept of neo-traditionalism for a number of years. I'm a freelance writer and work a lot with real estate people, developers and such. Ms. Plater-Zyberg may be familiar with a project called Amelia Plantation.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You've probably heard that mentioned a time or two, and the developer is an old friend of mine. And I toured it just a couple of months ago. I think we're carrying the demands, the specifications for format of life just a little bit too far. One of the things of the, and I like the reminder of the roots of this concept when we use the term neo-traditionalism, but one of the things of the old neighborhoods whose virtues are being rediscovered was that they were somewhat serendipitous. They just happened. They were not totally designed. That is, in terms of cultural diversity and things like that. Certainly the doors should not be closed to anyone who wants to come and live. But to expect that is a little bit like affirmative action, if you know what I mean, without being prejudicial in any aspect.
Well, Elizabeth, you know, go ahead.
In the United States, there actually is a tradition of town planning from our earliest roots, from the earliest New England villages, which had a town square, a village square in the middle, and had regulations, like you couldn't live more than a mile from the square because they wanted to be able to keep track of everyone in the wilderness, and how many sheep you could graze at any time on the green, and so on, to larger settlements like Savannah, which is close to where you are, Doug, or Philadelphia, or some of, at the turn of the century, probably many of our listeners know neighborhoods from the teens and 20s in their towns and cities, which are wonderful places, which were designed. So I would take issue with the fact that things are totally, the best things are totally ad hoc and serendipitous, because there are some of our most desired places are, in fact, have the hand of intention. And the idealism that does underlie celebration, the new urbanism, even Reston and Columbia, which are the prior generation of new towns. Mm-hmm. These are very important endeavors on the part of the American people on in terms of exploring the idea of community, of a country that's maturing and growing over time.
And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Earlier in our conversation, it was mentioned that the structures don't make a community. It's the people who do that. But the whole idea of this neo-traditionalism is that if you put the right structures in there, it'll incubate that community more than what we've had, you know, is going up in subdivisions across the country, if I'm understanding that correctly.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Just looking for affirmation.
So we can elaborate on that a little bit. I think some of the people calling in mentioned walkable communities, mixing uses, being able to walk to school, walk to shops. Earlier we were talking about teenagers, which really is an underserved group in terms of community life. That's an age in which the transition from the society of the household or the family into the larger society of a community and the world, it's a time of experimentation. And the physical context for that is important because when you hear that most teenage deaths occur by car more than any other method, and if you can imagine a place where at least some of their forays out of the household might be made on foot, as you can do in celebration to the movies or to any number of commercial establishments or to the lakefront, school, parks, other hangouts, you may not be taking care of all their activities. Andrew's right, there's a great unpredictability that's part of an important part of that age. But if you can at least diminish some of the dependence on the car, which teenagers now have, to get out of the house, then I think that's at least a few steps forward in keeping them safe to begin with, which is perhaps the most essential issue.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, we just have about a minute left. Andrew Ross, any final thoughts?
Maybe I'll just follow up on that question about physical design and community. The result of my book and the study that I did there was one of the questions that I asked perpetually, you know, to what extent does a physical layout help determine the community or sense of community? This is, you know, the basic principle of a lot of urban planning. And certainly what I would call relationships of proximity, there's no question that you can't live in a place like Celebration without getting to know your neighbors on a sort of basic everyday level. But then there are relationships of affiliation which aren't based on physical design. They're about friendships and bonds that are built up through churches or school or other community activities. And then on top of that, the third level that I discovered was that really the strongest sense of community that developed in Celebration, ironically, was based upon people's sense of hardship and adversity, the problems that they'd encountered. And in a sense, that was community being endangered or threatened, which brings people together and they assert their identity around resistance to the threats. Well, so ironically, sorry.
I'm sorry, but I'm afraid that's all the time we have
for
today. And I think we
wrapped
up there. Thank you so much. Andrew Ross is a professor at New York University and director of its American Studies program. He is author of The Celebration Chronicles and joined us from our New York bureau. Thank you so much, Andrew Ross.
Thank you.
And Elizabeth Plater-Zyberk, dean of the University of Miami School of Architecture and principal at Duane Plater-Zyberk Architects and Town Planners. She joined us from the studios of Motion Images in Miami. Thank you so much.
Thank you for covering this topic.
Earlier, we spoke with Dr. Brian Haas, who lives in Celebration. He spoke to us from Orlando, and Ron Dixon, a former resident of Celebration, who joined us from his home, which is now in Charlotte, North Carolina. In Washington, I'm Melinda Pencava, NPR News.
This program is a production of National Public Radio. The views expressed are not necessarily those of NPR, the underwriters, or this broadcast station. NPR is solely responsible for this program. Tapes and transcripts of this program are available. Call anytime, toll-free, 1-877-NPR-TEXT. That's 1-877-NPR-TEXT. Let's celebrate. We're gonna have a good time tonight. Let's celebrate.
Support for National Public Radio comes from this and other National Public Radio stations. Contributors also include the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, Hewlett-Packard, providing computer, communications, and measurement products for business, industry, science, healthcare, education, and personal use. The Pew Charitable Trusts, investing in ideas, returning results. www.pewtrusts.com. And the Geraldine R. Dodge Foundation for reporting on biological resource issues. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Although the presidential election is over a year away, Republican contenders are preparing for a straw poll in Iowa this Saturday. Critics say that since the poll costs voters $25 a pop, it's really more of a fundraiser. I'm Melinda Pencava. We'll look at what the Iowa straw poll means and what it tells us about the GOP contenders and their organizational and fundraising skills. Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.